This edition of The Menu was first broadcast on the 12th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to The Menu. This is Monocle's show on food and drink around the world. I am Markus Hippi. On today's program, we are off to Rome to see what kind of a take the city has on craft beer.
It's a beer that is just in the balance between the wine and the beer world, because it's made by 50% Duchessa. Duchessa is our spelt blonde ale, and 50% is Sangiovese grapes must.
And sticking to the theme of drinks, we hear of the ambitious plans English winery Ridgeview has for the future.
We've won an enormous amount of competitions, both domestically and internationally with the wines, which is a good sort of standard to reach. Even in 2010, where we were the first non-champagne to win the Decanter World Wine Awards.
We will also look at the latest in the push to promote sake in the UK, and we get the week's major headlines from our friends at Food Republic. All that coming up on this week's edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. We start this week in Rome to meet a beer maker who believes the craft beer market needs to be more creative and to experiment with new types of beers. Leonardo Di Vincenzo of the Birra del Borgo brewery has been at the forefront of the Italian craft beer boom that has taken the country by storm. Passionate about all things food and drink, it comes as no surprise that when the Italians embraced beer making, they did it properly. In recent years, the country has seen over 1,000 microbreweries pop up all around the country, with many Italian beers winning recognition internationally. Petri Burtsov reports.
I have come to Birra del Borgo Brewery, a short drive from Rome, to meet its founder Leonardo Di Vincenzo, whose beers have come to symbolize the Italian craft beer revolution.
Italy doesn't have a culture about beers, but I think that we have a really, really strong gastronomical culture. And also, I think that Italian brewers maybe think as beer as maybe a gastronomic product. So there is a sort of cross-connection between the gastronomic world, the wine world, and the beer world. That is the interesting part that I can say about Italian beer.
The Italian craft beer scene has been in the making for more than a decade, but has really exploded in the past 5 years, with Italian beers winning awards internationally and craft beer breweries popping up across the country. Rome is the epicenter of the Italian craft beer movement, with bars such as Ma che siete venuti a fa in the trendy Trastevere neighborhood attracting beer lovers from around the world. Birra del Borgo is one of the biggest craft beer brewers in Italy, selling about 13,000 hectoliters of beer a year. About a third of their beer is exported, most of it, Leonardo tells me, to the United States, the UK, and several Asian countries.
How do the Italian beers compare internationally if we think about some leading beer producers?
Obviously, the perception is, I think there is still a lot to do. If you talk with other brewers, they really are interested about what's happening in Italy because they heard a lot about all the Italian beers, all the new beers coming over, all the saison using specialty ingredients, the spontaneous fermented beer, all these things that are coming over. But if you talk with the general people, general consumers, also really, really fond about beer, they still doesn't know so much about the Italian beer.
Where do you see Birra del Borgo, let's say, in 5 or 10 years' time? What kind of plans do you have, both in Italy and then abroad?
So basically, what we think are going to do is try to grow a little bit more, but not only in terms of volume, but much more in terms of specification in products. So our idea is much more going, for example, in making some innovative products. So basically trying to make fermentation of different new beers and try to use wood barrels for trying to make more complexity and to use crazy ingredients to always to go over the boundaries of the traditional beer.
To prove his point that specialization in new beer styles is the way of the future, Leonardo offers me a taste of some of their more innovative fare.
Okay, so what kind of beer are we going to taste now?
Basically, it's a beer that is just in the balance between the wine and the beer world, because it's made by 50% Duchessa. Duchessa is our spelt blonde ale, and 50% is Sangiovese grapes must.
The taste is very fruity, very summery. I can see this being drunk, for example, on a picnic on the beach in the summer.
The peach, the apricots, they're coming always from Sangiovese part. And then you have a little bit of a sweet, malty character coming from the beer part.
Next, Leonardo opens a bottle of ale inspired by Etruscan brewing methods that date back nearly 3,000 years. The beer was developed together with the American brewer Dogfish Head and one of the leading beer scientists, molecular archaeologist Patrick McGovern. It has been aged in ancient terracotta barrels.
It's amazing how the taste lingers and develops in your mouth, and you get different notes the longer you kind of taste it.
Just in getting the nose, you can just get a little bit of the sweetness coming from the honey part and the malty character. And then when you just sip a little bit, you see the great evolution that you have in the mouth. At the beginning, just the sweet character, the malty and the honey comes back with a little bit of the spice character around. And then the evolution is incredible. Minerality, saltiness, a little bit iron character, sourness.
Leonardo is fairly critical of the current direction of the craft beer market. He calls for more creativity and more experimenting.
I think we're making a big mistake. The big mistake is, like the industrial market fulfilled everything with lager beer, maybe we're fulfilling everything with hoppy beer. But hoppy beer is just only one side of the different beer world. So what we're trying to do is just to try to escape a little bit more from the hoppy beer and go and try to present much more creative things. At the same time, I think in talking about beer culture, for example, Italian, also lucky because when some years ago I was speaking with some brewers from Germany or UK or Belgium, they say that we need to follow our tradition. So we cannot push boundaries or we cannot break our tradition. We'll find in trouble. And so that's also our freedom. This freedom, I think, it's our value.
For Monocle in Rome, I'm Petri Burzo.
And you are with the menu on Monocle 24. Champagne is the world's most recognizable region for sparkling wine, but English winery Ridgeview is angling to change that. The family-run vineyard makes wines in the South Downs of England and is expanding its sales abroad. They are on a mission to spread the word about the region's ideal soil and weather for bubbly. Owner Tamara Roberts sat down with Monocle's Megan Billings on a recent visit to New York.
We were at one point joined onto the continent and then moved away. So that southeast corner has sort of a very chalky, the South Downs are quite a lot of chalk, sandstone, limestone coming south from there. And that's the sort of geology that goes under the channel into that northern area of France as well, where Champagne is planted. So in that way, the soil structure is the same. And actually, I've had one or two winemakers or people who are well-travelled in the wine world who have never been to England before come along and say, hang on a minute, this looks pretty similar to Champagne here with various aspects of the geology that we have. So there are those similarities, but perhaps more importantly is the climate. The climate there we have is very marginal for growing grapes, which gives you a specific result at the end of a growing season, which is basically phenolic ripeness. So the grapes are completely flavor ripe, but the acidity is naturally high and the sugars are naturally low, which lends itself to this particular part, this wine, because you get a balanced wine, which is, when you make it sparkling, still has an element, that really sort of zippy acidity, but it's balanced by a great fruit, the fruitfulness from the grapes being properly flavor ripe, as it were.
So kind of coming back to expanding in the US, it feels like from a business perspective, you're kind of up against like a big monster. So you know, everyone knows Champagne. No one's thinking about this chilly part of England growing the same exact grapes. And so how do you approach really introducing that your wine can compete against this?
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's there's always a challenge. It was a challenge when we started in England because prior to sort of the sparkling wine industry exploding, wines over there were perhaps not very well thought of by even English people. So actually trying to get English people to taste our wines 20, 15 years ago was tough. But we've gone beyond that now. We've won an enormous amount of competitions, both domestically and internationally with the wines, which is a good sort of standard to reach, to the point even in 2010, where we were the first non-Champagne to win the Decanter World Wine Awards. So we actually came above Champagnes in that, which is quite astonishing, really, for an industry or for a winery that's, you know, back then, you know, it only reached its sort of 10th, you know, 15th year. You know, we're only 20 years old. That's nothing in wine world. That's just, you know, we're still a baby, as it were. So, you know, so we've had phenomenal success in terms of quality. And that's the most important thing. The quality has to be there. But yeah, coming to the US, I mean, you know, production for us has grown from 20, 30,000 up to now 300,000 bottles. And we made a deliberate choice to export early on because our industry is growing with lots of other competitors coming onto the market. And we just, the US to us just felt right. There's a lot of synergy, I think, between the British and the Americans as well. And quality, they like quality. You guys like quality. And if we can give you quality product, I think we can win you over.
And as an interested party and a journalist, I think it's only right that we try some just to prove the point.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, don't take my word for it. Let's try it.
So can you tell me what I am tasting?
So we've got a bottle of our signature wine, which is the Ridgeby Bloomsbury. The Bloomsbury is a blend of those three varieties we were talking about and always Chardonnay dominant, so has a very crisp finish on it. And is balanced out by a little Pinot Noir and Pinot Meunier on there as well. All of our wines reflect the year they're grown in. So this is a 2013 vintage. And it's a relatively new release of this particular wine. And yeah, it's a very fresh style, very reception type of style of sparkling to serve with canapés before a meal. With friends, whenever, you know. It's a good all-rounder.
It is very fresh. And is that a typical trait of your other wines as well?
Yeah, I mean, the one sort of redeeming feature of growing in the southeast of England is that the acidities are always very zingy, as it were. We don't struggle to keep them there. Sometimes to make the style of wine, you may have to sacrifice either picking a little earlier than we're talking about the sort of the flavour profiles being developed in the grapes. And if you have to pick them early to maintain the acidity, those flavour profiles won't be in the grapes. So you've picked them before they've come to their full ripeness. But for us, basically, we can leave them hanging on the vines pretty into October even, which means we get great flavours on the grapes as well as the acidity to balance out when we're making the wine.
That was Tamara Roberts of Ridgeview Winery speaking to Monocle's Megan Billings. You are with the menu on Monocle 24. After a short break, we look at the latest push to make sake mainstream in London.
The Foreign Desk is getting a little brother, the Foreign Desk Explainer. Each week we'll look at one of the world's biggest issues and, well, explain it. The Foreign Desk Explainer is a 5-minute nugget of information, analysis and opinion, and you can download it every week from iTunes, SoundCloud or, of course, Monocle.com. The Foreign Desk Explainer, available right now from Monocle 24.
You are listening to The Menu on Monocle 24 and I am Marcus Hippi. Well, here in London, the work to promote sake is in full force and one example of this takes place in just a couple of weeks when Hock's Cup Sake Bar Pop-Up opens its doors in East London at the end of this month. Curated by Natsuko Kikuya, who has founded the Museum of Sake, an intangible museum that promotes the drink in Europe, and designed by Soho & Co. Studio, the pop-up serves a selection of cup sake is gathered from across Japan. I invited Natsuko Kikuya of the Museum of Sake and Tom Holberton of Soho & Co. to Midori House to hear in more detail what's coming up and to discuss the current image sake has in the West.
So from 29th of February till 6th of March, we are having 1 week pop-up sake bar featured in cup sake from Japan at the Hoxton Hotel in the courtyard.
In London, indeed. What's interesting is that London, among many, many other world cities, has experienced this push of sake that's coming from Japan. But it's not that common to actually focus on one cup sakes that are slightly a different thing. Could you describe us what one cup sakes actually are all about?
So the one cup sake is firstly invented by Ozeki Company, so one of the national size big company in Japan, at the 1964 for the Tokyo Olympics. And so that the audience can actually hold a cup and open the tap and then drink straight from the cup. And then a lot of company followed it to have the same format. One cup is actually a company name, the product name for the Ozeki, but the cup sake itself has been very popular in Japan. And it's been quite an idea for the old guys drinking in the past, but now getting the craft sake brewery starting up to decorate the cup sake with very beautiful colors and designs and the different shapes and cups as well. So it's getting quite fun now.
Cup sake sound really handy. I wonder why they haven't become more mainstream yet.
Probably they still have this image of the cup sake to be for old people's drinking, and not many varieties so far. And also the probably that connects with our event. It's not casualized yet because the cup sake is a very casual drink. It's not something that you drink in a Michelin star restaurant. But sake in UK, we're trying to market the sake as a very premium wine or fine wines so that you can drink sake pairing with a French food, Italian food. But we haven't really marketed sake as a casual drink that you can drink at home or with your friends at home or outside in a casual pubs, for example.
Let's in a moment talk about what kind of cup sakes you have in this bar then. But Tom, I want to ask you about the design aspect of this pop-up. So as mentioned, the Wine Cup Sake Bar is going to be open in London Shoreditch on the first week of March. What kind of an experience have you wanted to create?
Well, we've got fantastic space. And so what we really wanted to do is create a bar in the round. And we've got this 20-metre long paper concertina bar, which we're having shipped over. And we think it will make this really sort of dynamic and vibrant environment, which kind of matches the playfulness of these cup sake, which would naturally come with this very nice kind of decorative design, something that has a very beautiful kind of graphic quality, which fits in with Hoxton. And we've obviously collected a whole variety from Japan. We're bringing them to the UK for the first time to show them off.
Natsuki, I know that you have curated the selection of cup sakes over there. So what is actually going to be there? What are the most exciting drinks you have there now?
So we do have over 20 different varieties that came straight from Japan. Many of them are just coming from the very craft sake breweries, like small, tiny productions, and they have really exciting designs. One of the quite popular one would be Kikusui Funaguchi, which is unpasteurized and coming in a tin cup. It's very cool looking and very, very fresh. It's almost like having a fresh sake when you open the cup.
Can you give us other examples?
Ozeki will be there as well. Mm-hmm. That's our original sake that's created for Olympics 1964, one cup Ozeki.
And many of them have quite kind of unique graphic qualities. And I think obviously the nice thing is if you buy one of these, you can drink the sake, but then you can take it home as well. So you get this sort of nice souvenir, which is otherwise unavailable in the UK.
I'm going to ask the next question from both of you, actually. So as mentioned, sake is gradually becoming more popular also outside of Japan. Tom and Natsuki, what do you think? What does it take for sake to get even more popularity, to take over the world for real?
There's two things. There's obviously a perception issue in terms of, I think it's a clear drink. I think a lot of people aren't familiar with sake, sort of associate it with a spirit and assume it's very strong. And I think what we're quite keen to do is to show the diversity. So, I mean, not only are we doing sort of the cup sake, we've got a number of tasting events along with the bar where we'll match it with different food because sake is really versatile like that. But I think the key thing is people really understanding it's like wine. It has the same ability as wine, which we're very familiar with in Europe, to go with food and to be drunk in all different circumstances, just casually and with fine dining as well.
And Natsuki, you are obviously the founder of Museum of Sake as well, which basically educates and promotes sake around the world. What are your thoughts? What are the next step in the future of sake?
Yeah, I think sake become a quite nice common name for everybody can recognize what it is. But the next step is to kind of getting out of the box of the image that the sake itself has. So everybody associates sake with sushi. And if you go to a Japanese restaurant once in a month, you have a cup of sake, which is a great start. But we have to get out of the images. And what we try to create is trying to combine sake with non-Japanese cuisines, non-Japanese images over. So we are pairing the sake with the Mas Brothers chocolate, also the Mark Hicks British food. So the smoked salmon match with sake actually perfectly matches well. And then cheese and sake is a great match because the sake itself has a lot of lactic acid inside. Yeah, that's the kind of the trial that we're having now.
And in this pop-up, there is going to be some original footage from the Olympic Games, 1964 Olympic Games. I bet, Tom, you have quite a lot to do with this.
Yes, yeah. I mean, so we've just been looking at various nice kind of amateur footage because obviously it's linked back to 1964. You've got the upcoming Olympics in Tokyo in 2020. So we thought it was quite a nice poetic reference. And so we've got some lovely kind of old colour footage to kind of put you in the mood of 1960s Tokyo.
And just finally, Natsuki, what do you think, what kind of an opportunity are the 2020 Games to actually give sake a world dominance?
I think that it would be a very great opportunity to appeal Japan itself to the world and actually sending the message to the world that Japan is not only kimono and geisha and sushi. We do have all sorts of different craftsmanship and different cultures and to entertain the world. So I hope that it would be sending a message that, you know, the sake is a very traditional drink, but it's also a very innovative drink as well. So I want to show this innovative side of sake culture to the world.
Natsuki Kikuya, founder of Museum of Sake, there with Tom Holberton, co-founder of Soho & Co. And Hawk's Cup Sake Bar opens in Shoreditch on February the 29th. You're listening to The Menu on Monocle 24, and let's finish this week's edition of the programme with a check-in on what's going on in North America. Joining me again on the line from New York is Richard Martin, editorial director of Food Republic, a website that covers food and drink culture. Welcome to the programme, Richard. So your first story for today is about wine fraud. What's going on?
Well, there's quite a lot of action in this realm of wine. Because wine has become such a collectible item, and it's such an international thing, it's reaching almost like art world levels of fraud. And it varies from wines being completely relabeled and sold at as something that it's not, to people stealing great bottles of wine clandestinely and reselling them on a black market. There's all kinds of different frauds that are being brought to the market, and it's causing a lot of shockwaves from Bordeaux to California to China and Australia.
How much can wine producers do in this situation then?
Well, I've been reading about what's happening with the market in China. Various attempts are being made by winemakers to try to rectify it. For the Bordeaux, you know, Bordeaux for many years was a very hot commodity in China. It was acceptable for Chinese government officials to give expensive bottles of Bordeaux as gifts. That law changed in the last few years, so the market for Bordeaux dropped off quite a bit in China. So the French have just kind of shifted attention elsewhere, back to the U.S. market, for instance, which they'd kind of neglected for a few years. Another issue with China is just fraud, or just people stealing labels and reproducing fake wine and selling it as if it's a brand name, you know, not unlike what they were doing with DVDs on the streets of Shanghai and Beijing. So Australian wine producers recently have been holding tastings of their wines in China and then smashing the bottles so that counterfeiters can't get a hold of the labels and reproduce, you know, Penfolds and some of the other name brand wines from Australia. And there have been reports of French winemakers doing this as well, just smashing the bottles as soon as the tasting is over so that nobody can get a hold of the label and then reproduce it.
Well, if we look at the situation in North America, then how big a problem is wine fraud there?
Well, there's been a big case in California over the past, since about November and then in January. Obviously, the California wine country, Napa, Sonoma, there's a lot of money there, and in San Francisco as well. So there have been a few issues there where the French Laundry, the famous restaurant that's on the world's top lists, you know, was suffered a $300,000 burglary of fine wines that has still not been solved. Another thing that happened last month in San Francisco is a place called Premier Cru, which was a very high-end wine shop that did a lot of mail-order business, filed for bankruptcy suddenly, leaving a lot of people who were waiting on wines to kind of get upset and say, you know, we were taken for a ride here. It's a little bit reminiscent of the Bernie Madoff scandal with the Ponzi scheme, from what I've been reading.
Well, on a lighter note, then, there is one Manhattan institution that has reopened now.
Yes. Koser's Bagels and Bialys is a New York institution that's been around for decades. And there were some reports in the New York media last year and the last couple of years that people just weren't going there anymore. Nobody was interested in the Bialy. And there was speculation that it would just outright close. But then suddenly it closed for renovation and just reopened last week. And people have been very excited about it. It's become a little bit of a sensation here in New York.
Well, Richard, the next question is, what is Bialy? I think we need you to explain that.
Yeah, so Bialy, I mean, it wouldn't be totally foreign to Europeans because it does have origins in Poland. There's actually a great book written by a New York Times writer about the search for the origins of the Bialy, and it traced it back to Poland. And it's actually a pretty sad story because this town called Bialystok, I suppose, which is where it came from, was ravaged by World War II, and there aren't many Jews left in this place, and that's where Bialys came from. But they have survived in New York, and until recently, they were not very in vogue. Now they're back, and people seem to like them as a sort of companion to the bagel. And how it differs from the bagel is that it's not boiled and then baked like a bagel is. It's just baked dough. And it's usually made with a little indentation in the middle that has onions or poppy seeds.
Sounds really good indeed. Earlier on today's program, we discussed sake. Is there anything going on the sake front in New York?
Well, I mean, sake is a popular drink here. It's not to the level of wine or even cocktails. It's always a little bit of more of a niche product served in Japanese restaurants. But you are seeing it pop up in some cocktails. There's also a lot of American sake being produced now, mostly on the West Coast, but it is becoming more prevalent here. So you have the option of either drinking Japanese sake or American sake, and the producers here are becoming more sophisticated, and it's becoming a more popular drink. I think it will continue to grow in popularity in New York as some of these different sakes become more widely available.
What's your impression of American sake?
So far, what I've had is very good. Obviously, it's nice to have a Japanese bottle. It gives that air of authenticity. But, you know, like what's happened with craft spirits in the United States, there are some producers that are extremely passionate about producing great product. And we're seeing a lot of that. I first tasted Taiku, which was a sake that was produced in America starting probably over 5 years ago now. And now there's a whole group of like craft sake distillers that have started, again, mostly in California. I think there may be some popping up in the other parts of the United States, but it's becoming more widely available. And through tastings and through the publicity that they've been getting, it's becoming more widely available. And it's very good. I mean, I'm not a sake aficionado by any means, but if in a pinch, I would certainly drink an American sake.
Thank you very much. That was Richard Martin from Food Republic. And that brings us to the end of this week's edition of The Menu. This program was edited by Alex Funnell. For previous episodes of the show, go to Monocle's website, SoundCloud or iTunes, where you can also subscribe to the program so that it automatically arrives onto your device every week. Also, do not forget you can read up on our picks of great food and drink and where to find them in the edit section of Monocle magazine. The February edition features a My Last Meal interview with star chef and restaurateur Nobu Matsuhisa and a guide to how to say thank you around the world. And the upcoming March edition will be all about Australia. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can reach me on mh@monocle.com. You have been listening to The Menu with me, Markus Hippi. Goodbye.